But anyway, that was we'll post that on our Facebook page. And if you haven't followed us, we're on Twitter, and at Live Saturday, and we're also on Facebook. So Google, Saturday Morning Live, or, on Facebook, search us. And if you want to get in contact with us also, our email is saturdaymorningliveradio@gmail.com, and you could get in touch with us. We're going to about to go to Amandla, and we have been, we're partnered with Amandla, the show out of CKUT. And we've been playing that, and we'll hopefully be able to reconnect with the Gorilla Crew here locally in Toronto. They're in transition right now, but we're about to play you this radio report around land grabbing in Liberia, out of the, you know, from the folks over there at Mandela in Montreal, via CKUT.
Of columns or documentaries or magazines or whatever you want to call it, by Feroz Manji. He's the former editor-in-chief of Pambazuka News, no longer, but he's a sometime resident of Montreal and has joined the Amandla team. And while he can't be with us tonight, he's off in Dakar, Senegal. He has left with us the first in a two-part series that we're going to be playing on land grabbing, an issue that we've addressed extensively here on Amandla. But he's taking a particular directed look at the impact of land grabbing in the West African country of Liberia. So what you'll be hearing here is a piece that Feroz Manji produced, where he's interviewing Siakor Silas, who is with the Sustainable Development Institute, and recently co-authored a report called Certain Futures Report. So here's their discussion.
You think say I didn't talk to you? I know they talk to nobody. Just listen to my sound.
Liberia is a country with enormous abundant agricultural resources. The country has a rich source of water and cropland. Recent reports suggest that there are substantial sources of oil and gas. Despite such natural wealth, Liberia remains one of the poorest and least developed nations in the world, with per capita GDP income of around $150 a year, with 40% of the adult population being illiterate and life expectancy at birth of under 40 years. The government remains the single largest employer, and most government jobs are available in the capital city only, Monrovia, and with little employment available in the counties. Most Liberians living in the rural regions depend largely on farming and sustenance for livelihood. Recently, there have been extensive land appropriations and speculation on land that have led to uncertainties and conflicts in some parts of rural Liberia. These have focused on land ownership and long-term land tenure. There has been little or no participation of local residents in negotiation of these concession agreements made by the government with international corporations, a factor that has often led to animosity between local communities and concession owners, or between government authorities and local people. There have been labour unrest and potential violent explosions. A number of international corporations, such as Firestone, have had large tracts of land handed to them back in 1920. And to protect their interests, many of these corporations hire ex-combatants to help police their hold on the land. Recently, large-scale land grants totaling more than 1.5 million acres have been made to Simon Dabe and Golden Verolium for oil palm and rubber plantations. These concessions are said to jeopardize land rights of local populations, threatening local livelihood and well-being of communities, and putting the future viability of one of the world's most significant biodiversity hotspots into doubt. A new report, Uncertain Futures, released by the Liberian NGO Sustainable Development Institute, presents testimonies of people affected by Sam Darbe's operations in Western Liberia and highlights the fears of others where the company plans to expand in the coming years. According to the report, the situation facing communities impacted by the expansion of Sam Darbe's plantations in Garwula District, Western Liberia, is dire. The plantation is on their doorsteps, and their farms and farmlands are being swallowed up by it. There are very few alternative livelihood options, says the report. My name is Firoz Manji, and today I will be speaking with Silas Siakor, campaigner for the Community Rights Programme of the Sustainable Development Institute, one of the authors of the Uncertain Futures report. Silas is one of the members of EJOLT and is one of the contributors to a forthcoming report from EJOLT on leaving the oil in the soil. Welcome to the program, Silas.
Thank you very much, Firoz, for having me.
Can you give us some background as to what's been going on, what this report is about, and what's been happening in Liberia?
Well, basically, there are a couple of issues to look at, starting with the allocation of the concession. The concessions are large-scale land grants that the government make to foreign companies to get involved in either mining activities or logging, or in this instance, agriculture. In 2009 and 2010, those two really large concessions were allocated, covering more than 1.5 million acres, to just two companies, cutting across a total of 9 of the 15 counties in the country. In both instances, nobody at the local level was consulted. The communities were not informed that these lands were being allocated until the companies showed up and declared that the government had allocated rights to them over the land where communities were already living and farming. And so in 2010, 2011, these companies started clearing areas to plant oil palm. In this particular instance, Sammy Darbe started to clear areas in Garwula District to plant oil palm. And through that, their activities, they did destroy a lot of farms belonging to local people. They did destroy a lot of culturally significant forest areas. The land around those villages were being cleared of crops and planted with oil palm. Areas where food crops were being grown was also being taken over and planted with oil palm. And as a result of that, the communities in that area desperately trying to get the voices heard, filed a complaint against the company. And actually, one of the conclusions or one of the issues that we highlight in this report is very much at the center of the issues we raise. And that is, during the negotiations about the community's complaint in efforts to try to resolve them, the company did concede that it had acted wrongfully by taking over this land without proper consultation. And as a result, it agreed to allow for palm that it had planted in some of the farmlands to be removed and for those areas to be cultivated for the communities to grow food. And for me, that is very, very significant because that is exactly what Liberia needs. We need more food. Nutrition is very, very poor. The government acknowledges that, and the government did promise in its own agriculture policy that it will invest significantly in improving infrastructure and providing inputs for farmers to grow more food, which is a bit of a contradiction when you see large-scale, fertile agricultural land being allocated to oil palm in areas where communities were already cultivating food crops. Then, of course, you begin to ask some questions about what exactly is the government's intention in all of this.
Let me get this clear. This land was assigned to this international corporation by the government. Is that right?
Exactly. The government allocated, in this instance, to Sam Darbe, 350,000 hectares, which is more than 500,000 acres of land cutting across 4 counties. So this was a government grant to an international corporation without any involvement of those residing, of those who have got private properties, private land in those areas. Absolutely no consultation with the locals on the ground.
Who exactly assigned Darbe? Are they a Malaysian company?
Sam Darbe is a Malaysian company, and it should interest you to note that the company actually, back in 2007, 2008, had acquired an old concession, the Goderich rubber concession in Liberia in that same area, which covered an initial concession area of 300,000 acres, which is fairly small in relation to the current allocation. So they acquired Goderich back in 2007, 2008, and then instead of the government allowing them to just focus on that area that had been acquired through their own merger with Goderich, the government instead decided to allocate additional areas, which then took the concession from 300,000 acres to more than 500,000 acres.
Who owns this property? I mean, does it not belong to the communities who've been living there and farming it for many years?
There are a couple of levels at which you could consider that. On one level, communities who live and use the land currently have rights under our own customary land tenure arrangements. The government recognizes their right to live on the land and to use it insofar they live in those areas. Those rights are clearly protected both in Liberian law and also in international law. The second level at which you can consider this is that there are individual families within those areas that have got private property rights over certain parcels of land. And in these instances, this is a situation where individual families have bought the land back from the state, and they've got legitimate titles to those land. The third dimension is that, for example, in one of the regions that will be affected extensively by this plantation, if it does go ahead, entire communities comprising of thousands of people actually got together back in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s and bought their own land back from the state and registered those land way back in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And they've got long-standing rights to those lands that has been recognized by the state, different governments over the years. And now this land is being targeted by the company. The government included that in the concession area. So again, you've got a situation of private property that the government is allocating to a foreign business interest without any kind of due process or consideration of the rights of the private landowners in those areas.
So those landowners, whether they're private or by customary law, haven't been paid for the land which has been taken away from them?
They have not been paid. There is no plan to pay them, to compensate them for the loss of the land. And we look at the contract in that respect, and also the implementation of the contract is testimony to that fact. For example, in Gawula, where the company had already cleared farmlands, they paid some small compensation for the crops that were destroyed, but did not pay any compensation for the land that had been taken over by the people who had cultivated crops in those areas in the first instance. Secondly, no replacement land were allocated to the people who had lost land as a result of the company's plantation development activities. So in this instance, you've got a situation where entire villages are being surrounded by the oil palm. They are not giving replacement land where they can cultivate food crops, and there's no compensation being paid to them for the land that they are losing to the company's activities.
So help me understand, all this land grabbing and making people presumably landless, how does that contribute to development?
I think that is where one needs to think beyond just this one company's actions. And if I may also add, this is not just in Gawula. This is the same situation that is already unraveling in the southeastern part of the country in Sino County, where Golden Beryllium, another international Singapore-listed company, operates. But the situation is that people on the ground now are saying to the government in a very pointed and in very clear terms that if this is what you refer to as development, then we may as well say no to this type of development. Because any development that disempowers people, losing their lands, losing their livelihoods, losing access to the only resources that they have and they are being able to use to lift themselves out of poverty, people are waking up and saying, sorry, but this is not the kind of development that we envisage. And I think if you put it into broader context, I think the model of development that has been pursued by the country is really, really not going to lead us in the direction that many Liberians would like us to go. And especially in terms of plantations, if you look at Liberia's history, back in 1924, 1925, when the first large agriculture concession was allocated to Firestone, then owned by Bridgestone in eastern Liberia, the president did go to the legislature and made exactly the same comment that this is development. We have to rely on foreign capital to develop the country and do not get bothered by NGOs and other detractors claiming that we are selling the country to these large-scale agriculture companies. But if you look at 88 years later, the reality of the people where Firestone operates is a story that's really, really appalling. Child labor is very rampant on the plantation, environmental degradation, the environmental footprint is really, really large. Labor conditions are extremely poor. Working and living conditions on the plantations are completely appalling. And the development that was promised more than 88 years ago has not materialized. And so this is the type of model that we think will continue to take Liberia in the opposite direction, away from any kind of development that resembles sustainable or equitable development.
We hear a great deal in the newspapers and television about how President Sirleaf Johnson has brought democracy to Liberia. How do we reconcile this with her government giving away 500,000 acres of land to this company?
I think there is a kind of state of denial on the part of the international community. I think there is growing evidence of a range of problems associated with the leadership of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. I think a lot of the issues that are being raised are being deliberately ignored by the international community because they will prefer to showcase Liberia as a success story. And that is not going to do very well for Liberia because we see a situation where this government is sowing the seed for future conflicts. We are already beginning to see that. For example, of the more than 1.5 million acres of land that has been allocated to those companies, they have been able to cultivate less than 30,000 acres. But already the conflict that we are seeing as a result of clearance on just the 30,000 acres is really troubling. And therefore, one can expect that as these companies expand further beyond into, say, clearing 50,000 acres going towards 60,000 acres, the amount of resentment and resistance from local communities is going to grow. And that is a very clear recipe for chaos and violence. And we've already seen that in Greenville, in Sino County, where Golden Verulam operates, two persons are in jail as we speak. And these are villagers that took upon themselves to clear the areas that have been planted with oil palm on their farmlands in order to cultivate them for food crops. They are languishing in prison as we speak at the moment. Recently, I was up in that region and talking to one of the local government officials. He was very pointed and very threatening. And he said basically anybody, any NGO, any local community activist that tries to disrupt the company's activities, he will deal with them in the most drastic of form. And so when you begin to see local officials and government officials taking such hard and very extreme, drastic push towards local communities and local actors and even national level NGO workers, then that is a really serious reason for concern. Unfortunately, the international community is not paying enough attention to these issues. And I think it is a grave mistake, and there is a real likelihood that unless something is done about this situation, we are going to end up with, in the next 2-3 years, with some very threatening situation of large-scale violence across the country.
But explain to me who benefits from both the selling off of this land and the growing of palm oil and rubber?
Well, I think the first line of beneficiaries obviously are the companies. They make huge profits on these investments. They make a lot of profit. They've got absolute control over how much of their profits they can repatriate. There's absolutely no limit to that. So the companies benefit enormously. On the second level, you've got individuals within government who benefit from some of these transactions. And without going into individual name calling, we've got situations where individual ministers or very senior government officials have taken shares in companies that have been awarded concessions. We saw one of these instances in the southeastern part of the country in the case of a mining company that had actually given up shares to a senior government official that was involved with the negotiation on behalf of the government at the time they got the concession. Then on the third level, I can say very clearly that senior government officials are the ones who benefit most from the taxes that are collected from these companies because they benefit from fabulous salaries. And these are also mostly people who work at the national level. When you go down to the local level, what individuals in these communities receive are a pittance. For example, they constantly talk about job creation. Here in the instance of Sammy Darby, for example, the overwhelming majority of the 3,700 people that are working for the company are classified as general workers. These people earn $5 a day. They work morning till evening. Sometimes they work for no more than 22, 23 days in which you get a take-home pay of around $130, $125. And you get given a bag of rice that gets deducted from your salary. So when you receive, say, for example, a gross of $120 and $44 is deducted for a bag of rice that you are given by the company, you are left with a little under $80, against which you then pay income tax. And so by the end of the day, your take-home pay is around $60-some-more. In some instances, we've seen pay slaves that register less than $50 per month.
Okay, you state in your report, and I quote, "To avoid future conflicts, the government needs to critically examine its policy on land allocation with a view to reforming the current process for allocating land to investors, especially in the agricultural sector." Now, what's your recommendation for the new policy that the government should adopt?
Well, the starting point should be a recognition that those who live on the land, those who use the land, those who occupy the land, those who have got private properties in those areas should be the first line of contact for anybody who would like to use any of that land for any kind of commercial activity. And the second line would be that the rights and interests of those people should be guaranteed in whatever agreements that are reached between the government and the company, and should actually be informed by the views of those people on the ground, should be informed by their own position. For example, we would like to see a situation, not only that we would like to see it, but it would make more sense if where the company would like to operate, communities in those areas would be first consulted and given the full breadth of information about what the implications, the impact of the development that's being proposed will be on their communities and on their livelihood. And based on that, a very mutually respectful discussion is allowed to take place in which those communities are allowed to say, yes, we accept, we acknowledge that there will be negative consequences, but we would like to go along with this project. Or basically being allowed to say, sorry, we do appreciate your explanations about how well this is going to benefit us, but we believe that it will have much more negative impact on our livelihoods than the potential benefits that it will deliver. And based on that, if they decide to allow these companies to operate, there should be very fair and equitable agreements that are reached between the landowners, whether customary or people who hold land under a statutory regime, be allowed to negotiate what would be the acceptable terms for them to operate. And all of this has to happen in the context of free, prior, informed consent and negotiations that are taking place in a non-threatening environment, in an environment in which the communities are supported by the state to negotiate a fair deal.
Are you saying that you're not opposed to the establishment of large-scale industrial agriculture? I mean, we know that this kind of agriculture has deleterious effects on the environment and is a major contributor to climate change. Are you saying that you're still not opposed to this large-scale industrial agriculture being introduced?
I would have to clarify my position on that. And on the one hand, as a Liberian and someone who's a bit informed about the potential negative environmental impact of these large-scale plantations, I have got my own views on that question. At the same time, I do respect that Liberia is a country that has emerged from a very brutal civil war. Poverty is extremely high, as you mentioned in the opening. Unemployment is extremely high. People's livelihoods, opportunities are very limited, and people are struggling to make a living. So I have to take those two perspectives into consideration in responding to that question. I believe, first and foremost, Liberia should focus on agriculture that delivers food security for the majority of the population. That is where we should be investing in agriculture, and not oil palm or rubber cultivation. That is my starting point. Liberia needs food. We've got fertile land. There is absolutely no reason why more than 80 to 90% of the rice that's eating in the country is imported from Asia. We've got absolutely no reason to rely on Asian rice imports. Having said that, if in a situation where communities are presented with a proposal for oil palm cultivation on their land, and they are provided the information that they need to make an informed decision, if they choose to go along that path, then our demand will be that they be supported to negotiate a fair deal that not only protects their rights and livelihood interests, but also their environmental well-being. It is very, very challenging in my situation, and I suppose a lot of people like myself who work in countries like Liberia, to stand up and say absolutely no plantation, because we are fully aware of the environmental consequences, because on the other hand, we are constantly challenged by the livelihood or poverty situation of communities in these areas. But I should quickly point out that in no instance have these large-scale monoculture plantations delivered for communities. They haven't delivered in the past. I don't believe they will deliver in the future. However, it is a bit of ethical dilemma for people like myself to stand up on behalf of communities and say, you say no because it will have environmental consequences. That's the dilemma that we face at the moment.
But it's certainly not bringing jobs to the communities. In fact, it's making a lot of people more unemployed, isn't it not?
It is bringing more poverty to people. It is creating more challenges for people because it is taking away livelihood options. For example, in Gawula, when we look at the situation where women used to be involved in small-scale businesses dealing with food production, for example, cassava, cultivating cassava, manufacturing that into different types of cassava products for food and marketing that to support their own families, they no longer have access to those opportunities. So effectively, you put all the women out of job in this instance. Where individual small cottages were coming up producing different types of arts and crafts at the local level that were then marketed. Again, those forest areas are being destroyed. So people are losing those opportunities to generate income from forest products that before were used to bring in income to support their families. So in a way, yes, it is putting a lot of people out of jobs. It is depriving people of livelihood opportunities. It is not creating the type of job that would leave people out of poverty. Certainly, $40 per month jobs can in no way lift anybody out of poverty. Not if you got a family of five or six to feed. That is not enough to take you through the month, let alone taking you to another level of status within your society.
In recent years, there's been a lot of interest amongst multinational corporations in investing in palm oil. Why this interest in palm oil? What is palm oil used for?
A lot of them would use palm oil in different edible food materials, basically different types of products that are consumed mostly in the West. And in other instances, people are increasingly looking to products from these plantations for biodiesel. And I think it is a bit of an irony that people's effort in the West to cast the lifestyle as being green is actually contributing to the type of environmental degradation that we are seeing in the South, especially in Africa, and the type of poverty it is bringing to people in the South, the human rights abuses that are associated with it. So while people in Europe may want to cast themselves as making the transition from fossil fuel or maybe diversifying their energy basis from fossil fuel dependency towards other renewable, in inverted commas, I should add, forms of energy, they are directly contributing to environmental degradation in Africa. They are contributing to human rights abuses. They are contributing to increasing poverty situation in the rural community. So this is by no means the type of sustainability that we think the world need to move towards, but rather move towards less consumption of natural resources in order for us to balance growing population, growing demand for food on our planet with our needs to be able to improve our own living conditions in places like Africa and other parts of the South.
I understand that you're a contributor to a forthcoming report entitled Keep the Oil in the Soil. Would you also argue that you should keep palm oil in the plant?
I think to put that into perspective, to put my position on the keep the oil in the soil into perspective, our point is that we have looked at many different countries in Africa where oil is being produced. We've compared the situation in those countries with the situation in Liberia. And the similarities that we have seen, for example, really, really, really poor governance in places like Equatorial Guinea, in Liberia, in Sudan, very, very high level of corruption. Again, common thread across all of those countries, human rights abuses, and very low performance on the Human Development Index. And I take all of that and say, if this is the context within which we are exploring for more oil in Africa, or we are aiming in Liberia to produce oil, then I think we are going to add more to the problem that we have in Liberia already than helping to solve that. So that's the context within which we talk about keeping oil in the soil in the case of Liberia. In terms of palm oil, I should point out that Liberia is a country rich in indigenous species of very local variety of palm that people harvest from the wild. And palm oil is a big part of Liberian diet. Unfortunately, the palm that's being introduced by these Malaysian companies, you don't eat the oil, we would not be able to eat the oil until it has gone through a whole range of processing chain, mostly, I can say, at this point in Malaysia, and maybe before some of that oil will find its way back to Liberia, whereas the traditional form of palm oil that people are used to, which is a big part of Liberian diet, is being cleared, is being destroyed, and being replaced with this palm that we don't eat in the country at the moment. I think that's a big problem, and therefore they should keep these imported palm species in the countries where they come from and let them produce the palm oil in Malaysia and Indonesia. And I think people in Liberia who would want the imported oil would be very happy to import it from Malaysia, and we can continue to have our native palm oil, which is a big, big part of Liberian diet, and a big opportunity for small businesses, big income generator for a lot of our families. That's how we would like to keep it.
Thank you, Silas Siako. We look forward to perhaps speaking to you again when the report on Keep the Oil in the Soil comes out. Thank you for joining us on this program, and best of luck in your struggles to get justice for farmers who've been dislodged by these multinational corporations. Thanks for being on our show.
Thanks a lot.
That was Silas Siako, campaigner for Community Rights Programme of the Sustainable Development Institute in Liberia.
And we just wanted to thank Feroz Manji for bringing us that interview. That was Feroz Manji, an interview with Silas Siakor. And in the weeks and months to come, not only will we have a series of interviews prepared by Feroz, but he will also be live in studio. We're thinking once a month with a personal column on a theme of his choice. Just to remind you, he's the former editor-in-chief of Pambazuka News, now occasionally residing in Montreal, and will be giving up some of his time for us here on Amandla. So it'll be wonderful. That's a kind of a nice little treat that we have in store for you for the New Year's. So we're just going to take a little musical break and we'll be right back.